by the hearts that are weary. The next step, unable to see.
Good evening. This is Janie Reisner. We've been listening to Many Are the Hearts That Are Weary from my CD, Okwaka Speaks, the words and music of Mother God. I think we have a lovely and intimate experience ahead of us listening to Patsy Harmon read from her book, author of Arms Wide Open, A Midwife's Journey. Patsy's first book was The Blue Cotton Gown, her memoirs as a nurse midwife working with her patients clad in the familiar blue cotton gown, which was called A Sweetly Perceptive Memoir by People magazine. And the book was a tribute to all women who triumph over adversity, honoring both those who struggle and those we heal. I interviewed her when that book came out, so it's a return visit for us. In Patsy's book, Arms Wide Open, she recounts her initial experiences as a midwife, coinciding with her years of hippie living in the 1970s. She recalls the everyday beauty and unrelenting challenges of living deep in the Minnesota woods in a log cabin she built with her partner, and later on a communal farm in southern Ohio. She describes the grinding work of daily survival, carrying water, chopping wood, washing clothes by hand, turning the soil for the vegetable garden, birthing her own three children. She remembers, too, her many internal struggles, including grappling with restlessness and isolation. Patsy, welcome to Women's Voices.
It's great to be here. It's nice to hear your voice, Janie.
Thank you. The first question I ask my guests is, how did your own mother influence you to be the woman you are today? What part did she play in all of that?
Well, my mom was a single mom. My father left early in my childhood, and this doesn't sound like the greatest influence, but really she was quite an anxious woman, and because she was, I felt I had to be strong and kind of hold the family together. So in that way, she influenced me. But she was a very loving person, very non-judgmental person, and I guess I got some of those traits. I also left her to go hitchhiking across the country and never gave a thought to it, and took her grandchildren, you know, on the East Coast. And now my kids live all over the earth, really, and sometimes I miss them a lot, miss my grandkids, and I think, geez, I did that to my own mom. I didn't understand, you know, the bonds that mothers have for their children.
Yes, that's true. When we're young, we really don't. It takes our own getting to that other stage and looking back. And where did you grow up?
Well, right there in the Bay Area.
Oh, did you?
I did, and I went to San Francisco State, and then I went further on in college. I went up to Oregon. So, yes, I was right there on Haight Street when Haight Street was actually Haight Street.
Wow. That's rather exciting.
Yeah, sometimes it seems like I had another life, you know. Like, who was that hippie chick? I don't even know.
And midwifing, was that part of, as you were growing up, did you have any leanings toward it that you were aware of?
Not really, no. Not at all until I had my first baby. And I lived in northern Minnesota, up around Duluth at that time, and there were no natural childbirth classes. And those were the days where women were really trying to take responsibility for their own births. Up until that point, you know, it had been pretty much either twilight sleep or gas or, right, you know, getting your baby pulled out with forceps. And women really wanted to do it naturally. And for us to do that in Duluth, we really had to fight to find a hospital that would let the father be there and, you know, not have to anesthetize me and do a big episiotomy and all the things that they used to do and sometimes still do.
Of course.
But in the 1970s, the Lamaze movement was new. And we were part of that, and we took a Greyhound bus six times, and we didn't have much money, so we had to take a Greyhound bus down to Minneapolis to take the classes. So that was after that, I felt like I wanted to share that experience with other women and help take care of babies.
Hmm. So you did have some training.
You know, we learned how to do the breathing. Later on, I say in the book, you know, the breathing isn't magic. It just gives you something to do when you want to run away, but you can't. So you might as well just do your job and try to do breathing. I say humming or singing backwards would probably work the same.
Uh-huh. And you also encourage people to blow.
Yes. when the baby's coming out, I would always have them blow.
Yes, yes. Were these always things that you just learned or you picked up from other people? Or?
I think I was pretty self-trained. I did a lot of home births before I ever went to nursing school or to nurse midwifery school.
Right.
And I really didn't have a mentor. I had books, and I read books, and I went and helped people have their babies. And that's part of Arms Wide Open, you know, my second book, is just looking back and wondering, who was this young woman, and where did she get the balls to do things like that?
I know. That is quite amazing, isn't it? I'd like to read a tribute to you, Patsy. It's a blurb for your book.
Okay.
Patricia Harmon's unflinching honesty and soaring poetry unfold the dream and the reality of the rural communes, political activism, and urban counterculture in the 1970s, and what we, the veterans of that particular era of bohemian life, have become today. She weaves in the telling tales, the songs we sang, the clothes we wore, the glories of nature we witnessed, and most especially, the cause for which we organized, and the austerities we endured willingly for the sake of the earth and all her children. That's from Alicia Bay Laurel, author and illustrator of Living on Earth. That's really beautiful.
Wasn't that beautiful? I think she really got it. I mean, she really got
what I was... Well, she sounds like she was doing it, too.
She was, and she has a wonderful book out. It was actually the first paperback ever on the New York Times bestseller list, and it mostly was little drawings with pictures of these hippie people having babies or, you know, building houses or having little rituals. But it was very inspiring, and I think people just ate it up. I mean, yeah. The counterculture was so strong then that it was a little Bible, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so moving. I'm just really touched by who you, Patsy, are, and Tom, and all those people you lived with. There's so much goodness, it sounds like. Like a gathering of really beautiful, conscious people. And you had deeply sincere goals and dreams grounded in the earth-based reality of your everyday lives. You made it work.
We did make it work. And I think, you know, when I talk to young people, you know, there is quite a back-to-the-land movement and people trying to be more sustainable and greener and you know, like the festival that sounds like you're having there in Mendocino in the next week or so or a few days. So that there's a resurgence of that. And when I talk to people, they say, do you think there's anything we could have learned from you guys? Because in a way, we did it all, and we did it very extremely, very radically. And I guess what I would tell people is don't give up your dreams, but moderation in all things. Because in the end, for me at least, that lifestyle was too hard. I just got tired of going to the outhouse and carrying buckets of water and, you know, digging in the earth, although I don't regret it for a minute. And I think it made me a stronger person. But, sometimes I say, would you like to live? I say to my husband, would you like to live like that again? And then I say, except we don't have to have an outhouse, do we?
Right. Well, there could be just a few niceties, right? Make it a little bit easier, like running water.
Right. And that's my point, I guess. If you make it too extreme, you'll burn out.
It's hard.
And in the end, that's kind of what happened to us.
Right. But that you did what you could, seems to me. You made it work with very little.
And I think part of the theme of Arms Wide Open is that we don't give up. You know, we change as the years passed, and some of things we leave behind and some we bring forward with us. The real question is, what do we do now?
Well, yes, I was thinking you've had such a unique experience. I'm thinking you might want to teach some survival techniques to the rest of us.
Maybe.
For when things get really tough, which seems they're going
to be.
I've
thought of that.
Truly, yes, yes. Well, I wonder if we should start reading. It seems to me that's so important to hear your beautiful words and hear those stories.
Oh, I'd love to read.
Great. I want to say this is KZYX. I'm Janie Reisner. You're listening to Women's Voices. And my guest, Patricia Harmon, a nurse midwife who whose newest book is Arms Wide Open. Well, why don't you go first, if we're going to take turns or at least do something like that?
The book starts out, for the listeners, with me tromping through the woods in Minnesota, and I live very far from the nearest road with my companion, Stacy, and our little boy, who was about 1 year old, Micah. And we built our own log cabin, and it was what I thought I always wanted. It was sort of a little house on the prairie, or little house in the big woods lifestyle. And this is a story, well, I'll let you hear for yourself, called Thief. It's not really a story, it's a chapter, but it's sort of a standalone chapter. Thief. A string of days like lapis and jade on a golden cord, the dark blue of the Minnesota sky, the deep emerald fields of midsummer, the yellow goldenrod. Dawn, and the sky is just turning white, and I roll over in bed, spoon around my lover, ready to return to sleep, but the sound of distinct scratching on the front door arouses me. The first thing I think is, it's some passing dog, although we've never seen a stray out this way before. I picture one of our neighbor's canines and shuffle barefoot in my birthday suit to the window to look down. A black bear squats on our porch, gazing around in the pale morning light. Stacy, I hiss, we've got company. My lover hoists his head. Come over, look. Pointing down, I'm as excited as a kid at a zoo. The bear turns his black head as Stacy leans over me. Where? My companion asks, rubbing the sleep out of his eyes. I point straight down on the steps, where a mound of black fur now stands up on his hind legs, sniffing. Shit, he must smell our food. He's probably the thief that destroyed the beehives. Stacy reaches into the toy box, grabs two of Micah's big wooden blocks, and starts clacking them. Get out of here, he bellows as he clumps down the stairs. I follow him, nude, and we both stop and peer through the small window at the shaggy animal, his drooling mouth so close I could smell his foul breath through the crack in the door. We've got to get rid of him, Stacy worries. If he starts thinking this is his feeding station, we're in trouble. The creature drops to 4 feet again and wags his head, none too swift to depart. Shoo! I holler as I grab a metal spoon and pull a pot off its nail, banging them together. Shoo! The beast backs off the porch, glares at the window, then licks his chops. That ticks me off, and I throw the door open, almost hitting him. I mean it! Shoo! Get away from our cabin, you fucker! I've about had it with you! I told you this was war! I'm standing naked, 6 feet from a huge black bear, banging on a saucepan. Shoo! I holler again. The bear ambles leisurely down the trail toward the spring, and then stops and looks back. His or her round ears silhouetted in the golden morning dawn, each hair on fire. Suddenly, the animal appears friendly to me, gentle and curious, and I'm half ashamed I called him fucker. I was only trying to shout something nasty, as if he'd be insulted, his feelings hurt. Then I remember the bees and the destruction of the hives, and I get mad again. Pounding on my soup pot, I chase the bear down the path. Get away from here! This is our den! Shoo! I mean it! I'm serious! Stacy is standing on the porch laughing his head off at this hippie version of I Love Lucy. He's doubled over, he's laughing so hard. Micah, in his blue footy pajamas, watches with big eyes as his wild, butt-naked mother chases a 400-pound bear through the woods.
Wow.
True story.
Amazing. And it had a good ending.
It did. It didn't attack me.
Wow. Well, your adrenaline was moving.
It was.
Wow. Well, that must have been very hard living there. With you didn't have a road that even came up to the house. Is that correct?
No, we had to carry everything in. We were able, we actually had found an old Finnish log cabin that had been used as a farmhouse and enclosed with clapboard siding, and that was the basis of our cabin. We were able to take it apart and label the logs like Lincoln logs And somehow, I forget how we were even able to do this, but we got the logs hauled in, maybe with a tractor or something. And then we put it back together, and we made a log house. And that's how we built it.
Mm.
And recycling.
Yes, and I have the impression that it was quite beautiful inside.
It was. It was very nice.
I mean, you had carpentry details. And
yeah, we had cabinets. And, you know, I always liked painting. So, you know, I would decorate wood chests with birds and flowers and things like that. I think it was very aesthetic.
Hmm.
All heated with wood.
Uh-huh.
Big old cook stove like they have in Little House on the Prairie.
So you were living just the two of you with your child there.
Yes.
So that wasn't communal living yet.
No, we had been lived in several communes before that, and it seems to me I was always the one looking for utopia, and for some reason I would decide that this one was just a little too far out, or this one was too scary. One of the ones we lived in was the Committee for Nonviolent Action in Connecticut, and that was hardcore political, and we sometimes would have people who were our political adversaries come to the farm and even shoot up the house, and that was too scary for me. Then maybe a different one might have had too many drugs or something, and that was too druggy for me. So we kept moving around and finally ended up on this farm by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we had hopes other people would join us, but after I thought about it, how many people, especially with children, would want to live like that?
Mm-hmm. Too hard. Too hard.
Well, especially washing diapers by hand. That's kind of a deal breaker for a lot of people.
Well, yes, I would think. Gosh.
And we didn't have Pampers then.
No. Wow. Okay, well, do you have something next that you'd like to read?
Well, I saw one here that you liked a lot, and this was Aquarius. The book is divided into three journals, the Green Journal, the Red Journal, and the Silver Journal. The Silver Journal brings us up to present time, about a year after the Blue Cotton Gown ended, for those who've read that book. And Aquarius is a story about a contemporary woman having a baby. And it wasn't a birth I was at, but I thought it was very beautiful. It's raining again, a steady gray drizzle, the wettest summer I can remember. The creeks rise over their banks. There's flooding in the southern part of the state. Whole trailers, all that families own, float downstream like wood chips. The raging mountain rivers bring torrents of muddy water into our lake. But at last the sun shines. Mara, my friend from the commune, and I sit in the gazebo looking down at the sparkling water and watching two bluebirds court in the lilac bushes. I was so surprised this afternoon to see her as she came down the drive. Our friends, on her way from Maryland to Berea College in Kentucky for a conference on women's issues. She does this sometimes, just shows up. I heard an interesting story the other day I start up. It made me think about our home birthdays. You know, there are more women than ever choosing to deliver at home. The C-section rate in the U.S. is over 33%, and the higher it gets, the more families will opt to stay away from the knife. So let me tell you this. This was a wild one. I got this from my midwife friend, Rain, in Ohio. A doula, pregnant with her third baby, wanted to have a natural birth. She'd had two previous C-sections, one for breech, pretty traumatic, she said, and the other just because her OB said she had to. Well, why wouldn't they let her try? They used to. Mara takes a sip of her iced tea. Well, it's an example of how medical malpractice insurance companies end up calling the shots. They either refuse to insure a hospital that does vaginal births after cesarean, or they make the restrictions so hard that the providers and the hospitals give up. Anyway, let me tell you this. This woman, Sophie, I think that's her name, contacted my friend Rain. She's one of the few nurse midwives who do home births in Ohio. They came to an agreement, even though Rain lived 3 hours away. So last week, Sophie called, after midnight, that's the doula, to say her water had broken, but nothing was happening, so she was going to go to bed. She told Rain to go back to sleep, too, and she'd call her when the contractions got harder. Rain got up at dawn, packed her birth stuff, and was already on her way when the pregnant woman called again, this time on her cell. Where are you? Sophie asked. 2 hours away in the car on the road to your house, Rain told her. Are you in labor or what? Are you having contractions? Yeah, they started, but they aren't that bad yet, the woman tells her. My husband is filling the portable birth tub. I figure the baby will come sometime this afternoon. Rain, the midwife, picks up her speed, but she still isn't worried. 30 minutes later, however, her cell rings again. This time it's the husband. How's she doing? Rain asks. She knew the man wouldn't be calling if his wife could talk, so it must be hard labor. Where are you? The guy demands. No hi or how you doing. 90 minutes away. How's Sophie? Pretty cranky, and I'm worried contractions are getting close. Well, what's she doing? Is she in the bathtub? Tell her to get out. It's too relaxing. Get her in bed on her left side to slow things down. Yeah, right, Mara interjects. Slowing down a woman who's had 3 babies is like slowing down a semi-truck coming down a mountain grade. I nod in agreement and go on with my tale. She won't, the man says. She tells me that contractions will hurt like hell if she gets out. He's all upset, swearing and everything. If we'd gone to the hospital, this wouldn't have happened. When you think about it, you can't blame the guy. His wife's been attending births as a doula for over 2 years. She's comfortable with the process. The only deliveries he'd seen was in an operating room. So, Mara says, so what happened? Well, the next call Rain gets as she's hurtling down a narrow secondary road is Sophie again. You can stop speeding, the mother says. There's mellow music on the stereo in the background. Well, the cool thing is this woman got her dream. She had her baby.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, I skipped a page. She had her vaginal delivery after cesarean section. She didn't mean to do it alone, but the baby came out. She caught it herself. Holy cow, Mara exclaims. What if something had happened? You're right, but it didn't. She just put her hands under the water and held on, eased it out, first the head, then a gentle push of the shoulders, just a little grunt, and the whole body slipped into the water. She just flipped it over and let it float to the top. This is what Rain told me. Just as it came to the surface, the baby's eyes opened, and they gazed into hers. They named the baby Aquarius. The dawning of Aquarius, the age of Aquarius. Remember that song? Mm-hmm. Mara muses. Yeah, but can you picture it? I take Mara's hand. Sitting in the birthing tub, looking into your infant's face, 3 inches under the surface. You'd have a minute or two. The newborn won't breathe when he's still warm in the warm water, and the placenta's attached and pulsing. Can you imagine? His little head is cradled in your hands. He scrunches up his face, and then he opens his eyes, luminous, holding all the wisdom of the ages.
That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. Wow.
Why don't you read one?
I will. It's 7:30. The time is going really fast. It's 7:32, as well as I can tell, and it is KZYX and Janie Reisner and Women's Voices and my guest Patricia Harmon, author of Arms Wide Open. Okay, I am going to read something called Flying. Okay, 179. You're hitting the phone again. You're breathing.
Sorry.
179 here. Let's see, here it is. Okay. With care, I fold our best clothes and stuff them. Do you want to kind of put this into context? You're living with your second husband.
Yes, this is Tom, who is my husband now. He's an OBGYN. At this time, he was just a hippie guy that, you know, was a paramedic. Not a paramedic, an EMT. And we lived on the communal farm and was in West Virginia, actually. And well, the story goes on from there. We've been having kind of a rough time, and many people, after the war in Vietnam ended, our community sort of slowly dissolved. People went back to school or got jobs, sometimes in the nonprofit sector at shelters for women or, teaching for something like Head Start. So the commune was slowly disintegrating, and I was having a pretty hard time with that. And so that's kind of where flying, that chapter starts.
And you've also had, haven't you had another child?
I have, yes. We have Orion and Micah at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. With care, I fold our best clothes and stuff them into a knapsack. I'm packing for a four-day excursion, a mini vacation in Athens, Ohio, that Tom arranged because he knows how low I've been since Mara left and the parasite made its appearance. We haven't been on a trip like this since our honeymoon, when we hitchhiked to Williamsburg, snuck into the grounds of Colonial National Historical Park, and slept illegally in a tent under the bridge. Mara and Ben have offered to take the boys as a gift for my delivering Dylan. Tom comes up behind me and tosses me on the bed. Hey, cut it out. We're both feeling giddy, rolling around, messing up the quilt. I can take you easy. I'm sitting on his stomach, pretending I'm pinned him. You're all mouth and no action. Tom rolls me off with ease, holds me down, and gives me a long kiss. Come on, you've packed long enough. Let's hit the road. Good morning, flying squirrel, I call out as a small soaring rodent sails across our path and lands spread out on the trunk of a maple before us. It's a chilly day with a clear sky, no leaves on the trees, but the grass on the ridge is green from the rains. My good mood bubbles over. Some glad day when this life is over, I'll fly away, I sing at top volume as we tromp across the ridge and then across the partially finished road across along Anne Marie's fence line. An echo comes up from the hollow, I'll fly away. 2 hours later, we cross the metal bridge over the Ohio River in Parkersburg. Tom breaks the silence. What do you want to do in Athens tonight? I blink myself awake and squint at the traffic lights. Everything, let's get dinner and go to a movie. And it must be 5 years since we've been to a flick. We took Micah to Star Wars and Spencer a year ago, remember? Well, it was 5 years before that then. And tomorrow you can take me to the music store where you used to work, and I'll get some guitar strings. Sunday I want to go to Quaker meeting. In Athens, we do all the things I hoped for and more. Shop for kids' clothing at the Salvation Army. Trash pick an old maple table we find on the sidewalk. Watch mallards land in the blue-green water of Dow Lake. On Sunday, our last day in civilization, we wander over to the Ohio University Library. In a private glassed-in reading room, I rest my elbows on the scarred oak table. So, what does Thomas Harmon want to do with the rest of his life? I tease, as if I'm a host on National Public Radio. I'm surprised when my husband answers me seriously. I've been thinking. Remember when we were at the food co-op the other day? That couple from New York that was talking about their 10-year plan? Nothing like that ever entered my mind. We've been so focused on being here now, but I like the idea. I've been asking myself, what would I like to do in the next 10 years? I thought maybe I'd start by getting certified as a paramedic and eventually go to school to become a physician's assistant. I'm taken back by this revelation and a little pissed. How come you didn't say anything? Like he's had a big discussion with himself and I've been left out. I didn't want to get in a fight. I know how important the commune is to you. I study my husband, seeing him in a new way. A man taking charge of the future. Aren't you afraid of being co-opted by the system, losing your ideals? He laughs through his nose. No. Above us, dust motes dance in the light through the tall, many-paned windows. I hadn't wanted to talk about my fantasy of becoming a nurse midwife. It makes me feel disloyal to what's left of the community, as if we're plotting a getaway. But since he shared his dream, well, I looked into the LPN program. Tom tilts back in his chair and waits. If you get your LPN license at Archmore, you can get your RN in one more year at Parkersburg Community College. Now that I've started, my fantasies flow like water from a spring in the hillside. You need to be a registered nurse to become a certified nurse midwife. We could do it, the two of us. I could open a birthing center. You could become a physician's assistant. We could start a free clinic. Once I begin, I dream big. And Tom sits straight up in his chair. I almost skip to the reference desk, borrow a pencil and paper, and begin to sketch a collective future that we've never imagined. Can I really give myself permission, after 15 years of living in the most Spartan manner, at Tolstoy Farm, CNVA, Chester Creek House, the homestead in Minnesota, and on the ridge at No Name Farm, to make such a radical change? Is it possible? We could move into Spencer this winter and rent a little house. I could apply to the LPN program and, if I get in, be paid by CETA. You could take care of the kids during the day while I go to school. Tom breaks in, scratching the cleft in his chin. In the spring, we can move back to the farm, work the gardens, and live in the longhouse. I could continue as an EMT a few nights a week, and when you're a nurse, you could support us while I go to school. There are moments in your life when time speeds up like a film on fast forward. This is one. We excitedly draw timelines and maps with circles of the distance we'll have to move from Roane County, the center of our world, if I'm to become a nurse midwife and Tom's to become a paramedic or a physician's assistant. We have no idea how we'll pay for our education or how we'll take care of our children, but we are euphoric. We've done difficult things before. What's this compared to building log houses, cultivating fields with only hoes and spades, hauling water for a quarter of a mile, walking through blizzards? Nothing seems impossible. There you are. Hi there.
I'm here.
Oh, good.
You read so well.
Well, thank you. That's a wonderful vignette. That's a wonderful view into how this shift came about.
Yes, and it's, there are certain moments in your life that you are very crystal clear, and I think that was one. I kept journals all those years, and the first two-thirds of the book are based on those journals, and then the silver journal is my laptop, and my hair is now silver, so it's more current time.
Yes. Generally, we open up the phone lines, and how about we do that in case people want to call in and ask you questions or whatever? Would you like to read something?
Well, I did. I thought of something since we talked a little bit about how Tom and I decided to go back to school and become medical professionals, and this kind of skips quite a few years later. We're now living in a lakeside home in a nice suburb, quite unlike where we used to live. And Tom, the mild-mannered hippie guy, is now an OBGYN surgeon. So sometimes you look at your life and you're really not sure how you got there. And this is a chapter called Healer.
Okay.
What's up? I ask as I come out through the open deck door. Tom sits with his feet up on the porch rail, staring across the lawn. I'm just waiting for a call. A patient I did surgery on a few days ago came back to the emergency room this evening. Two gray squirrels with curly tails are eating birdseed spilled by the careless blue jays 2 feet away from his chair, but he doesn't even notice. His cell phone finally rings, and he flips it open. Dr. Harmon. I listen to the one-sided conversation, watching his face. There are circles under his eyes. He's been harassed with phone calls 2 nights in a row. Yeah, so how are our vitals? Okay, wait for the lab results. Type and cross her for 2 units and make her NPO. What? I ask when he hangs up. I've got to go back to the hospital. His voice is low and discouraged. I tighten my lips. Can't you eat dinner first? It's my patient, Bobby Boyd. The RN says she's orthostatic. Blood pressure's way too low. Is she bleeding? Not on the outside, but she oozed all through surgery. I ordered a post-op hemoglobin and blood clotting studies. They're pending. I guess I can grab a bite. 5 minutes later, his cell phone rings again, a catchy salsa tune that belies my foreboding. Dr. Harmon, he says again. Okay, I'll be right there. Call the nursing supervisor and alert the OR. What's happening? Her hemoglobin is 6. He doesn't have to say more. 6 is way too low, and he's already heading toward the front door. It's a warm evening, and I'm outside in the gazebo staring down at the lake. The air smells like lilacs, and even if I was blind, I could tell by the scent that it's almost summer. The fireflies come out one by one. It's the first I've seen this year, but I don't get as excited as usual. Tom's still not home. Because of his specialty, pelvic pain, my husband takes care of many women who've been referred to him by other gynecologists, surgeons, and family docs. There are women with endometriosis and adhesions, women in delicate health or with autoimmune diseases that lead to poor healing, patients the other docs prefer not to mess with. Tom always accepts them. I think of the worst. What if Bobby Boyd hemorrhaged and died? Tom's never had a woman expire after surgery or childbirth, and I don't know how he'd handle it. Finally, the lights of the Forerunner come down the drive. Tom, out here, I call across the lawn. How'd you do? She okay? My husband sags into the deck chair next to me. Yeah. I think that's all he's going to say, and I'm afraid to ask more. Finally, we had to give her another 2 units of blood, 4 altogether. By the time I opened her, I couldn't find a bleeder, but there was 1,000 cc's in her pelvis. I picture the amount is almost a quart. Her labs showed a coagulation disorder, he continued. I stayed a few hours longer to be sure she was okay, but her husband was pissed. I imagine the man, skinny and tall with a scraggly ponytail, wearing a tight AC/DC t-shirt. He sits on the edge of the hospital bed, tightens his jaw, gets out a pack of cigarettes, then remembers he's in a hospital and puts them back. When Dr. Harmon comes in, weary and wearing light green scrubs, the fellow jumps up. What did you do to her? Will she be okay? She better be okay. The vibes were heavy, Tom continues, discouraged. The guy's an asshole. I see the way he treats Bobby when he brings her to the clinic. He talks for her, bosses her around like she's a piece of shit. I don't think he trusts me. I stand up behind my husband's chair and run my fingers through his short gray hair and across his forehead, pull his head back until it rests on my stomach. He's such a good man. It once seemed so easy. We wore our hearts on our sleeves and were here to serve the people, first by attending home births when there were no birthing centers or hospitals with humane protocols, and later as medical professionals who changed those protocols. When Laurel left the commune, Tom came to be my driver as we sped through the night to home births, down a hollow or up on top of a mountain. He boiled water and sat in the kitchen. The fathers appreciated having another man around, a reassuring presence in a sea of femaleness. I appreciated him because he was an EMT and available if we had an emergency. Now he is the captain of the ship, the one in charge, losing sleep over surgical complications and worries about medical malpractice litigation. When we step out of the gazebo and look up, heavy clouds have come in, and the stars are wiped out. What did you think of that one?
Mm-hmm. Yes, lovely.
It's not that lovely. I mean, it's good. I think it's good writing, but it's a little sad, don't you think? I think it's a little sad.
Yes,
but we have to have a little sadness in life, I guess.
Well, yes. I mean, I think it works. I've read the book, remember?
I know.
No, it's very touching and very, yeah, I'm sure.
Very real. I think
course.
It's real.
Of
People
course
sometimes
it is.
Forget what doctors and nurses and medical professionals go through. I mean, I think a lot of times we look at them in their white jackets or their blue scrubs and don't realize, you know, how human they are, just like us.
Also, I think you have a really intimate, I suppose other doctors do too, you seem to have a really intimate relationship with your patients, I mean, because of the department you're in, you know, working with birthing and afterbirth and women's problems, all of that. Are you there? Yes,
I am there.
Yeah.
And I think you're right, the kind of work we do is very intimate.
Yes, it is.
I think, you know, partly because we had quite a life before we went back to medical school makes us unique, though, too. I mean, we were parents. Well, I've taught medical students, and I know, you know, many young people go straight through school and right into medical school, and
right.
I don't think they're as sensitive healers because they haven't yet had much life experience. It's been all book learning.
That's very true. I have another piece I want to read, but before I do that, do you have a website?
I do. It's www.patriciaharman, and Harman is spelled HARMAN.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there's portions of the books in there if people like to see them, and a little bit about my life.
I'll say once again, this is Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reisner here with my guest, Patricia Harman. If someone would like to call in, the number here is 937-5103. And you mentioned something about Facebook. Are you on Facebook?
I do. I have a Facebook for a page for the books, Arms Wide Open and The Blue Cotton Gown.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also have Patricia Harman.
You do?
And
well,
I love to talk to people.
We have a telephone call. Good evening. You're on Women's Voices.
Hi. Thank you for the show.
You're welcome.
I am curious about what's the current legal status in different states about home births and what states are more lenient or more open. And because I'm not in the field at all, so I was just curious what the current status is about that.
I know California is one of the more liberal states. I don't know of any state where home birth is illegal. But the question becomes certification of providers. Some states will only certify or license nurse midwives who have usually, they have an RN and then they go on to graduate school for training in midwifery and women's health. Some states will also certify women who have a different path, and it usually is an apprenticeship at the end of which they take a test similar to what a nurse midwife would take. Some states don't have any certification for the midwife who wants to do home birth, and that is a problem because people don't know whether they're getting someone who is well-trained or if just somebody decided they'd like to do home birth and put up their shingle. I can't be critical because if you listen to the rest of the earlier parts of the interview, that's exactly how I started.
Right.
People were having home births. I had taught classes and seen one or two babies born, so I got books and studied up and started assisting them. And in a way, you could say, well, he didn't have anyone else, but still, it's not optimal. You know, it's not, I don't really think it was the best way to do things. It all turned out fine in my case, but it doesn't always turn out fine.
Right.
And part of the story of Arms Wide Open is there's a couple references to very sad situations where they were unable to get the baby out. The baby was stillborn.
I wanted to read your chapter, Akila, A-K-I-L-A-H.
Yes.
Akila. I think this is so sweet. You don't remember me. The woman sitting next to me who looked to be in her late 30s, dressed in slacks with an embroidered wool vest and long dangling beaded earrings, smiles and asks again, "You don't remember me, do you? It's been a long time. You delivered my first baby when I was 15. I'm Serena, Serena Holt." "Was this in Cleveland?" "Yes, at Case. I was a single 15-year-old mother, and you took care of me in labor and then helped me give birth naturally. I have two kids now. The one you delivered just started college. The other is still in high school. I'm trying to remember. There have been thousands of births. Tell me something about your labor." "Well, it was a long one. My water broke at 3 a.m. and I came to the hospital with my grandmother. My folks had all but disowned me, kicked me out when I told them I was pregnant, called me a tramp. I was living with Graham, but she had to work. She had just gotten on with the Board of Ed and couldn't afford a day off. My water was leaking, but I wasn't having hard contractions yet, still in latent phase. You sat with me, a scared kid, all alone. You entertained me with stories of the hippie days and how you became a midwife. You told me about other young girls like me who had gone on to college and made something of themselves. I always remembered this one thing you said. I often use the same words with my patients. Labor is like playing cards. You don't get to choose the hand you're dealt. You just play the game the best you can. Life's like that too. Anyway, once the contractions finally kicked in, I went fast. My grandmother made it back to the hospital, and then my parents showed up. You wouldn't let them in the birthing room until after the baby was born. You said it would distract me, that I had to concentrate on getting my job done. The baby was posterior and my back hurt like hell, but you got me through. That day changed my life. I named my little boy Aquila. It means wise. You believed in me when no one else did, and here I am. She dips her head and passes her hands in front of her body as if introducing someone rare and beautiful. I finished high school, started community college, went into nursing, got my master's degree, and became a nurse midwife because of you. When I was an RN in labor and delivery at Case Western University Hospital, we nurses used to tell stories about you after you left. Funny things you did with the patients. We called you the wise woman. The wise woman? I almost choke. In many countries, the title midwife means wise woman, but I am a child staggering through life. I wipe the corner of my eye and give my fellow midwife a hug. Life is a journey, and you never know whose life you may touch.
Very nice.
How beautiful. What a tribute to you and the whole process.
Well, I've been very blessed, I think, to have that kind of work. And, you know, I don't deliver babies anymore, and it tells about that in the blue cotton gown. And sometimes I think, maybe I shouldn't call myself a midwife, but I think the things I do with women are the same, which are, you know, empower them, give them support, and teach them how to be healthy. And that's exactly what we do when we're midwives. And you're a midwife, too. Maybe we're all midwives for each other.
We're all midwifing each other into new experiences.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful way to think about it. We're getting close to the end. It's 7:57. Is there anything else that you'd like to say?
You and I talked a little bit about this before, and I think sometimes what I see we're doing in this country to childbirth is the same thing we're doing to the earth. It's a sin of hubris and pride that we think that we can improve so much on nature, and we end up really messing it up. I think we do that with childbirth, and we've pretty much done that to the earth. Now we have to figure out how to change things back.
I know. It's so true. It's so heartbreaking. These precious things, precious beings, children, and our precious earth, that really gives us so much. It's very sad.
But we can't give up hope, and because I think hope is what makes us human. And sometimes you look around at the world and you think, boy, you know, we have a lot of challenges in front of us, and I feel quite overwhelmed. But I do think we have to have hope, and we have to believe that it's possible to change things.
Well, you're certainly doing a job of that in your own life as much as you can. And you're still in practice, your husband's in practice, and you're still doing your work with women.
That's right.
And your children, they've all grown up.
Well, three boys, still struggling their way along. Uh-huh. We have good days and we have bad days, but two of them are fathers, so I'm getting to watch what good dads they are.
Yes. Well, that is lovely. Thank you. You know our time is really gone. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful speaking with you, Patsy.
Well, I really appreciate it, and I hope people like the book.
I hope they love the book. They should. It's very wonderful. It truly is. Good night.
Night. Thank you, everyone.
Unfolding our love.